This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Created equal.
From WDET in Detroit, this is Created Equal. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm in the studio with the show's producer, Carrie Jr. the second. Hey, Carrie.
Hello.
So, Carrie, when's the last time you were at the grocery store?
Ooh, I actually just went to the grocery store this past week for a couple items.
Yeah? Did you buy milk? Like a gallon of milk?
Not milk.
No?
I also get oat milk, so it's already a little pricey.
Okay. All right. Well, you know, in some places in the country right now, you can pay as much for regular milk as you might be paying for oat milk.
Wow.
Because of this thing called inflation, which we've been living with for a while in this country.
Yeah. I almost fumbled your setup there. But you're right. According to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, food prices have risen 25% during President Joe Biden's tenure from 2019 to 2023. And the most recent report from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, consumer prices rose 3.5% in comparison to March of last year. But what Biden's trying to argue in the flip side of this is that unemployment is down and that inflation is much better than it was at the peak of the pandemic. But it doesn't seem like folks or Americans are feeling like we're in a better spot, even though Biden is touting some of the changes or the adjustments he's made to that economy in response to the pandemic and a lot of other things.
The effects of COVID and the breakdown of the supply chain combined with a lot of federal government spending has just sent prices, through the roof. And interest rates have gone with them. I noticed this article in The Atlantic recently by a guy named Michael Powell that talked about the sell that Joe Biden is using for his reelection campaign. And the fact that the fact that it says kind of, hey, don't pay attention to that pesky inflation.
Right.
Things that I did as president have really helped out middle class and working class people, and that's what we should be focused on. And Powell says, "Look, that's kind of a con, right?
It's also hard to do as someone who's living day to day, seeing the prices and seeing how much more of your budget is being chewed up by."
That's right. That's right. And if you're somebody though who has investments or stock portfolios or all kinds of things that are doing well right now, you may be able to ignore inflation, right? I'm doing really well with these things. So I don't know, inflation doesn't matter as much. But of course, most middle class and working class people are not heavy investors in those things. And so they're hurting. And so I wanted to have a conversation with Michael Powell about this piece, but also about this tension inside the Democratic Party between Democrats who do well financially and the core of Democratic voters, which is middle class and working class people. That's the folks that the Democratic Party has always said is trying to help. So I want to start with the premise, really, of the piece that you wrote in The Atlantic, which is really, I think, that, the Democratic Party is a more economically diverse party than many people might think. I think the Democrats are generally categorized as the party of the working class and to some degree the middle class, and that they are champions of the things that those Americans need. But in the narrative of this year's election, which is aimed from the Democratic standpoint, of course, at reelecting President Biden, you have a different voice that's coming through, which, as you characterize, is the voice of kind of a liberal elite, a wealthier class of Democrat, trying to convince middle and lower working class Democrats that, hey, things are better than you think they are, and this little inflation thing, this little inflation problem that is costing you more at the grocery store or at the clothing store or wherever you're buying what you need, don't pay attention to that. Everything's going to be okay. Is that a fair characterization of what you've written here?
Yes, it is. I think with perhaps the one caveat that, I mean, I'm sympathetic in that to the Democrats in that it's an election year, right?
Yes,
so
yes.
You don't it their truth is not its own reward in an election year.
Right.
So there's there is an added incentive to say, hey, everything's cool. Don't worry about it.
And when we talk about the Democratic Party and this message, I think it's important to kind of note exactly what people are facing. And you do in the piece talk a lot about the effect that inflation is actually having, not just on the economy overall in a macro sense, but on people's lives, that this is much more disruptive than anyone seems willing to sort of admit, especially inside the Democratic Party.
That's right. And I think part of the problem is the way, which is what a bit of what I get into in the piece, is the way we define technically inflation, or even core inflation, it's
mm-hmm.
called,
mm-hmm.
which doesn't include a whole lot of what they call volatile categories. One of those volatile categories is food.
Yes.
So food inflation has been, well, I guess a year ago it was running at 20%, and it's up overall about 22% since 2019. So that's a lot of, you know, that's a lot of money. And if you're a working class or middle class person, you're feeling, I mean, that is an inflationary cost, right? But it's not measured in the, again, in the inflation rate. So it leads to this kind of strange cognitive dissonance where economists, some of them quite wealthy, mm-hmm. are insisting to people, oh, no. This is kind of, it's what they call a vibe session. You know, it's like, it's your vibes. It's like, you know, kind of in your head.
Right.
But, you know, like you're getting to the counter at the grocery store and your bill is up 20%. You know, that doesn't feel like a vibe. That feels very real.
Yeah. Yeah. And when we talk about, you know, the inflation that we're suffering and that people are seeing at places like the grocery store, let's talk about the things that are causing that and why in an economy that otherwise seems to be performing quite well. And a little later in the conversation, I want to talk about those indicators too and what's going on there. But what is it that's causing at this point, 4 years after COVID, which was, I think, the initial kind of, you know, igniter of the inflation, the government spending as
sure.
in response to COVID. Why are things so bad right now?
You know, let me back up. I mean, it's not as bad as it was a year or two ago.
Right.
Of course, it's not, I mean, I take your point, 4 years since the beginning of COVID, but of course the very worst kind of inflationary costs were perhaps a year and a half ago.
Mm-hmm.
The debate now is kind of how the narrative, let me back up, the narrative for many Democrats, for a number of economists, is that we've all but tamed inflation.
Right.
And we've bought it way down. Yeah, we had it, but it was a temporary thing. It was a surge caused by all of the spending the government was doing to try to help people see people through this terrible time. And it's basically over. If you look at it in a number of other ways, that's simply not the case. I mean, first place, even core inflation is running at 3%,
mm-hmm.
but in many costs are running substantially higher than that. So it's, you know, there can be several things going on at once, but I mean, I think, you know, with food, I mean, some of that is supply, some of that is like supply chain.
Mm-hmm.
Some of that is, in the telling of some economists, might be what they call greedflation. The, you know, companies, large companies taking advantage of this moment and hiking prices. you know, you have also, you have then another effect, which is one of the things that the Federal Reserve, or really the main thing that the Federal Reserve has done to try to tame inflation, is to raise interest rates,
right,
which have gone up threefold. You know, that increases costs across, well, I'll finish my thought. That increases costs across the board in a whole variety of ways. I mean, if you're getting you're buying a used car or a new car, the cost of that loan, the interest you're going to be paying, it's going up. Well, I guess on new cars about 75% to 80%, on used cars closer to 100%. You have, you know, mortgages going up. You have rental centers where particularly working class folks go to get, you know, and anything from dining room tables to a chaise lounge to whatever, those interest rates are way up. So they kind of across the board, you're seeing, again, inflationary costs that are not calculated in the underlying rate.
Yeah.
I should back up and just say, it may be that there's no choice, right, that to tame inflation, you have to raise interest rates. That's certainly the traditional remedy, and there's, you know, good evidence you may have to do that. But you have to, from my point of view, we have to then acknowledge that comes with real pain, and it comes with real pain not for upper middle class and wealthy folks, but for those kind of working class, lower middle class people that at one time were the real base of the Democratic Party.
Right, right. So I guess one of the questions then is is the party gaslighting middle and working class people by saying what we're hearing it say during the election, which is, hey, you know, again, things are much better than you think they are, and just hang in there, and all of this will resolve itself. I mean, is there something, I guess, at base of that that's manipulative of those voters?
Yeah, I think in a sense, the question is to provide the answer, right? I mean, yes, it is somewhat manipulative. I don't, I understand it's a presidential election year.
Yeah.
So, you know, one nuance is a very hard thing to do. So you want to go out and say, look, which is true, unemployment has fallen. It's, you know, somewhere around 3%. Inflation is down, but not where we'd like it to be. I mean, you can kind of make those arguments, but I think those arguments scare a lot of prominent Democrats. Now, I should say some Democrats, Bernie Sanders, Sherrod Brown in Ohio,
yeah,
some others have talked about, you know, the continuing tough time for particularly working class and middle class voters. So it's not like it's all Democrats, but it's certainly, yes, I think it's fair to say that the dominant message is at odds with the day-to-day reality of life for many Americans.
Yeah, yeah. And inside the party, I mean, you point out Sherrod Brown and Bernie Sanders, you know, two Democrats who sit further left than
yes,
the mainstream of the party. You know, normally during an election year, you'd have a push and pull between those two wings of the party. I mean, if you go back 4 years, of course, you had an open primary for the Democratic candidate. Same in 16. Why aren't we seeing that kind of jockeying take place, I guess, from a political standpoint this year? Why aren't those voices on the further left of the party gaining more traction or gaining more volume, I guess, in the middle of this election?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think that one of those goes as well, frankly, to my line of work, which is journalists and writers and opinion makers. I mean, there is, frankly, this argument that inflation, you know, is the specter of inflation is still a deeply felt experience for many Americans, is not a popular one, and yeah. not one that you're going to get. I say this not to congratulate myself. I mean, I've seen, but like one of the I'm the vessel. But there was one of the economists I talked to, Isabella Weber, who is herself, I think, fair to say, a left liberal economist. She's been speaking a lot about these inflationary costs. She's talked about perhaps the need for price controls, say, when it comes to food. And she's actually gotten a pretty good reception, particularly in Europe. But over here in the United States, she's been greeted really as the skunk at the garden party. I mean, she's been dismissed. Her ideas have been called, you know, truly silly and stupid and this sort of thing. So there's a real fear. And look, it's also the age. All of this is happening in the shadow of Trump, right? So I think there's a great desire on the part of Democrats to smooth over what were these kind of, like, say, as you point out, these kind of left versus kind of liberal center disagreements over the economist. Let's not talk about that right now. I think that's politics, problematic. Yeah. I also think it's risky politically.
And in what sense?
When you start telling people that your visit to the grocery store, your visit to the used car lot, where it seems like things are really expensive to you, that's all in your mind, man. That's a vibe. That's a vibe session. You know, that isn't your real reality. That's a problem, right? I mean, you don't want to tell people that it's all in their head. Yeah. Let me put it another way. People don't like to be told that it's all in their head when they look at their bills. So I think that's, given that the Democrats already are having problems with particularly working class voters, and not just white. I mean, there's been real slippage among Latinos and among African Americans.
Yep.
You know, that's a real risk to go out and start telling people, now you're not what you are seeing day to day is not your reality. That's a tough one.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll continue talking with Michael Powell about the economy, about inflation, about the Democratic message in 2024, and some of the things that President Biden actually has achieved for middle and working class Americans. How come they're not paying more dividends? Stay where you are. We'll be right back with more Created Equal.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm glad you've joined us. We're talking with Michael Powell. He's a writer for The Atlantic and has a recent piece that points out the gap between the message that Democrats are selling this year in an election year, saying that the economy is in good shape and people should send the president back to the White House to help him continue the work that he's begun in the last 4 years. Meanwhile, though, of course, there is this nasty problem of inflation that is really crushing working class and middle class voters. That strain could, of course, cost President Biden the election in November. We're talking about the economy. We're talking about inflation. We're talking about what Biden might be able to do to win those voters over or to be more faithful to them. Michael, I want to start this segment talking about some of the things that the president and Democrats have to sell to voters this summer and fall. The list is not short of things that President Biden has gotten accomplished that, in the long term at least, would really help middle and working class Americans. So let's just talk about a couple of them. The ARPA funds that states have gotten, I mean, in some cases, billions of dollars that have flowed into states to do all kinds of things that they wouldn't have been able to afford on their own. The Infrastructure and Jobs Act, the expansion, again, of the child tax credit, which when I talk with anti-poverty advocates, they now speak in terms of eliminating child poverty in America. That seems within reach for them now because of the things that President Biden has done. So with a resume like that, you would think this should be a pretty easy case to make. I want to talk about why those things have maybe enhanced or exacerbated the problem with inflation, and whether the message that says, "Hey, hang on, hang in there," of inflation is something that goes up and down. These are permanent things that we've put in place that will make life better for the base of the party.
I mean, look, that's a great point, right? I mean, the point of writing my piece was not to argue that there's no accomplishment, that Biden can point to no accomplishments. Clearly he can. And unemployment is way down, right? I mean, there's been wage growth for the first time in quite a while. It's run again ahead of official inflation, not ahead of all inflationary costs, but nonetheless, that's an accomplishment. There's more unionization. I mean, there's a number of things that, some of them directly attributable to Biden, obviously things like unionization, more part of the zeitgeist or the environment. And those things are things you can point to. One of the problems he confronts, and this isn't unique at all to Biden, is that with some of the infrastructure programs you pointed to, I mean, those were real accomplishments. He got those through, as we know, a deeply polarized Congress. But the distance between cup and lip and on those projects, in other words, between getting the okay, we can do whatever it is, alternative energy, we can do highways, we can do wind farm, all that kind of stuff takes a very long time. And there's a striking number of those projects that are still not in the ground, right? I mean, there's not even construction going on yet. That, again, is not unusual. I mean, it cuts across parties. One could certainly argue that it points to the need for regulatory reform, but that's, those are kind of, those are different issues, right? So, I mean, but that is part of that problem. So, sure, you've passed that stuff, but has it translated into jobs immediately? Again, you could argue, well, this is unfair. God is unfair, right? I mean, that this stuff may go up in a year or two, and if his opponent Trump wins, then people say, oh yeah, well, Trump was president, that thing happened. But the point is that distance between cup and lip, that's why things like inflation and, frankly, in fairness to Biden, things like employment are so important, because that's immediate. Yeah. I mean, that's what you're experiencing in your daily, the daily reality of your life.
Yeah. So let's talk about jobs, which I didn't put on that list and probably should have, because it's absolutely among the president's most dramatic accomplishments is the job growth. And it's been surprisingly robust in the last few months, especially. Why hasn't the job picture done more to not alleviate inflation, but alleviate the idea that inflation is such a problem? I mean, the labor market is better right now than I can remember in maybe the last decade in terms of the jobs that are available, jobs that pay really good money and have benefits and all of those things. How come that is not making more people feel better about inflation? Talk about the relationship between those two things.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great question. And look, some of this may be like kind of a delayed echo effect, right? So, and that's certainly one of the fervent hopes of the Biden administration, of his campaign, is that as this, you know, as kind of month after month, the employment rate remains low and frankly surprises a lot of people, because I think when everyone thought when interest rates went up that you were going to see a drop in, you know, monthly job creation. And so far you haven't seen that. So it could be that they can point to a real sweet spot, and that by the time we come to the fall, again, that kind of daily reality of people's lives will start to reflect that, right? That you're, well, you know, there's a lot, yeah, costs may be high, but, you know, I've got a job, my kid's got a job, my cousin has a job, and by the way, wage increase, you know, there are wage increases that are running at least near the rate of inflation. And as we know, you know, for a long time, wages, particularly at the lower end, were very depressed, and that is less so the case now. So that's certainly something they can point to. I mean, look, you also have there's a non-economic reality, which is that Biden also needs to sell that, right? I mean, he needs to sell that reality. And there I think there's an open question, right? I mean, he's not putting aside all, you know, any issue of, you know, his mental capability. I mean, let's assume that's all fine. He's an older man, and it's hard to get out on that kind of the hustings in the way that a Obama or a Bill Clinton could have, and just kind of go up and down, you know, the country saying, you know, this is working, this is working, you're working, you've got jobs, you've got salaries. And so I think that's one of that kind of the sell job looms as a, you know, I think a big question mark for the president.
Yeah. In your article, you get pretty deeply into the economic side of all this and the way the economy works. One of the things that's kind of occurred to me over the last 4 years, and especially in the last few, is that maybe some of this is about a shift in the economy. In other words, that the rules that would apply from, you know, past instances of this kind of government spending and this kind of inflation are somehow being rewritten by the current economy and you know, dynamics that didn't exist before. Is that something that we ought to be kind of thinking about?
I'm sorry. So what do you mean? I'm not quite clear by, you know.
So in other words, why, given all of the great things that are happening in the economy, does inflation persist the way it does? Is something different that is fueling inflation that maybe we hadn't dealt with before and that we don't quite understand how to deal with?
That may be, but I mean, I think on the other hand, it's not – I mean, look, in fairness to, you know, whoever was the president at the time, when you go through something like a plague, right? I mean, a worldwide plague in which millions upon millions of people are dying, you've got vast dislocations in your economy. All of a sudden, you've got, you know, tens of millions of people working at home. You've got others working in fear of their lives. And you're trying to keep those families afloat, or I shouldn't say just families, keep people afloat financially at that time. You're pumping, I mean, that is the government is pumping a lot of money into the economy. It happened under Trump. It absolutely continued under Biden. And I think most economists, and frankly, of less moment, so do I, see that as an incredibly important decision that kept families from going under. Mm-hmm. And so that was an unintended, unexpected thing that government had to do. It created inflationary, it created inflation in the economy. And for a while there, it created a scary amount of inflation. So that I'm not sure, I mean,
So this may just be the way it goes. This may just be the way it works.
This may be the way it goes. And look, inflation has come down. Even those who take, such as myself, a grimmer view of inflation. I mean, it's running now, if you were to factor in all of these other things, interest rates, that kind of stuff, maybe 7%, 8%. It's not running at 25, 30%.
Right.
It has come down. There's every reason to expect that it probably will continue to come down, though I should note in the last month it kind of jogged up again.
It did, yeah.
Right. So, I'm sure that's worrisome for the administration. But anyway, so there's all of these. I mean, there were these, kind of terrible word, but this was a massive exogenous event, something that came in from the outside. It was like the financial equivalent of an asteroid hitting. and I don't, so I think that any president could fairly say, wait a minute, I didn't create 20% inflation because I was simply, writing wild checks to people.
Right, right. This happened for reasons I couldn't control. It also occurs to me that I would love you to kind of quickly talk about your kind of outlook for this thing. I mean, when you balance the inflationary side against the effects, the long-term effects of the things that the president has gotten done, barring other outside unexpected events, things should get better for working class and middle class people under those policies. I mean, is it your estimation that would happen? That as inflation subsides, these other things would take hold and make things opportunity and wealth accumulation and growth better.
Yes.
Yeah.
In a word, I mean, I think that is, as I say, there is this, this no doubt frustrating if you're in federal government, and certainly frustrating for those outside of federal government, this time lag between when these things are passed. Mm-hmm. So, you see a big, these big bills were passed in 21, 22, and why isn't it, I don't feel it out there. Well, in part that is, you could fairly argue that in some cases, perhaps the federal government should be working harder to cut through red tape, but it also just takes a long time to do this stuff.
Yeah.
There's a reasonable expectation that if the President Biden gets a second term, that by 2025, 2026, you're starting to see some of this stuff going into the ground. Then it's going to be up to him to remind people, hey, that's me. that's
that,
the Democrats
right.
that did that for you.
Yeah.
And that's a whole different, that's a different case. But it's if he were running in 2026, he probably could point to, you outside of Nashville, you're working in this factory because mm-hmm. I got a bill passed in 2022 that did that. He can't do that yet.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, we're going to take another quick break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Michael Powell of The Atlantic. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. You're listening to Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm glad you've joined. We're talking with Michael Powell of The Atlantic about a piece he's written about a kind of schism in the Democratic Party in 2024. Michael, I want to talk about what's happening at the sort of other end of the Democratic Party that you point out here. This liberal elite group of of Democrats what's happening for them, in some ways, it seems as though, and this is not just true inside the Democratic Party, of course, this is just true in America, that people who, for instance, who don't just live on a salary and manage their money that way, but who are investors and have portfolios, are doing very well. Right now. I mean, I think anybody who has investments has seen how in the last 4 years they've done quite well. And if you go back to, the end of the Great Recession, I mean, they've just done phenomenally. And yes. It seems to me that in some ways what's happening is that something like inflation, of course, makes that way better for investors, right? Higher interest rates mean bigger returns, and if you're an investor, that you're the beneficiary of that. So in some ways, inside the Democratic Party, this is a push and pull. This is an either or. That as the suffering gets worse for middle and working class Americans, returns get bigger for people at the top of the scale, and that's who controls, both political parties to some extent. I mean, can you talk about that part of it and the strain that represents?
Sure. No, I think that's a great point. And I mean, I think what we've seen in the last, and it's been charted by, a number of very good analysts in the last couple of election cycles, is the Democrats' share of the top 20%, the top 5%, the top 1% has increased very steadily to the point that I believe in 2020, at all those levels, the Democrats were equal to the Republicans at that kind of upper class, with their percentage of that upper class vote. And that's that's a big historical turnaround. I mean, that traditionally the Democratic base is kind of more middle class, working class. And as that, so as that happens, right, I mean, it creates a, a very large and, more to the point, very powerful interest group within the Democratic as well as within the Republican Party, which has, done well historically with that group.
Yeah.
For policies that may hurt working and working class and poor and middle class Americans. And it isn't necessarily, one needn't think that it's, oh, this is, some Democratic financier who's trying to think, well, how do I, how do I grind their nose? No, it's just, as they say, enlightened self-interest, right?
right. So let's start with if you're, part of this Democratic, this historical Democratic base, you're just getting crushed, really, by increased costs. And I think you do a really good job in your piece of pointing out how difficult this is. How would you ever, or why would you ever believe, I guess, that people who stand to benefit from, things being that way, have your best interests in mind? And that's not just a question, of course, for Democrats. It's a question for both major parties, for sure. I think this is an age-old question. Can you trust that if the people in charge stand to benefit from the things that make it harder for everybody else, why go out and vote for them, right?
Right. No, it's a great problem. And even as we were talking about earlier, I mean, even the, if you will, the more I was going to say benign, but let's say necessary measures. So raising interest rates, you got to do it because you got to break the back of inflation. You know, and I think that would be pretty, not universally, but pretty much seen by economists across the spectrum and not simply wealthy economists as a necessary thing. The problem is that that does, you know, those, that move directly hurts people who are working class and poor and middle class. So how do you, maybe in a way it's finding a, for the Democrats, a language, or it's their lack of a language in talking about that with people, saying like, right, I realize you're getting hammered here. And by the way, it's all right for my 401k or, you know, for those above the 401k point, you know, it's good for my investments. And I do think in fairness to the president, in the recent State of the Union, he didn't spend a lot. In fact, he never mentioned the word, say, Bidenomics.
Right.
I mean, and he did talk about greedflation, right? I mean, the sense that that some large corporations are profiteering, and that they're profiteering at the expense of the middle class. And I think it was his attempt to kind of address that problem he has. It is a problem because, I mean, in some substantial parts, certainly his donor class, I mean, is, you know, very much of that 1%, no different than the Republicans, by the way. But on the other hand, the Democrats are traditionally see themselves as, you know, the tribunes, if you will, of the middle class and the working class. So it's probably more of an existential question for Democrats. I mean, Republicans are already trying to kind of move, you know, a more populist inflected language and that kind of thing in an effort to pick, you know, born of the realization that the Democrats are now struggling with what used to be their base.
Yeah. So I think the flip side of that is also then the question of what kinds of policies can you pursue if you're Joe Biden to show that, hey, I feel what's happening to you. I see that, you know, inflation is not going away as quickly as we'd like it to. You're getting slammed with it everywhere you go. So we're going to do something about it. And one of the perhaps most easily available ways to balance things out is through tax policy, right?
Yes.
You know, those of us who are, you know, reaping benefits from, you know, stock portfolios and other investments don't pay the kind of taxes on that money that ordinary people are paying on their salaries. And Democrats used to talk a lot about, hey, you know, more people need to do their share. That seems woefully absent from the narrative and the dialogue these days. The idea that you could levy more of an excise, really, on all of this largesse that is happening as a result, in some cases, of the inflation itself.
Right, windfall profits. I mean, you could do a bunch of things, and you're right. I mean, that there's very little talk of that. And, you know, look, okay, so you could say, well, in part, you know, the Democrats have the most tenuous control possible of the Senate.
Sure.
And obviously don't have the House. It would be perilously difficult to get, maybe even impossible to get through, you know, kind of a substantial tax reform. Though it's worth noting Trump got tax reform, Republican tax reform.
Yeah, in the opposite direction. But
in the opposite direction, right. So, you know, you could – and that – right, so begs the question about the Democrats. And I think at the very least, you could talk about it, right? I mean, you could say, look, give me control of the Senate or let me retain control of the Senate. Give me control of the House, which is, you know, very – I mean, you know, there's a a couple vote difference. And I will do, you know, we will do tax reform. And you're absolutely right. That is a, that's something that kind of strikingly absent in the conversation right now. And is another way of saying you're willing that for the Democrats to say that you're willing to essentially, you know, gore your own ox. I mean, you know, to go after your own donor base in, you know, if they want to talk about enlightened self-interest, you know, in the interests of the broader party in the broader country.
Yeah. I mean, the strain that exists in that way, the political strain, does seem more at home in the Democratic Party, I guess, than in the Republican Party. But I think it does raise the question about, you know, about an election year like this one, where, as you point out, there's only a narrow Democratic advantage in the Senate. They don't control the House right now, and they've got a president whose poll numbers suggest he might have a hard time in November. So tell me what you would do if you were Joe Biden. What's the right message and what's the right action to show that, hey, I get it, and my hands are maybe a little tied, but here's what I'm going to do to make sure that you're taken care of.
Well, I mean, one of those things is to talk about right taxes and to point out the way in which the Trump tax reform made life better for the very wealthy and worse for other Americans, to put forward your own ideas. So that would be one way. Another thing that, and in fairness, in this case, the case I'm about to mention, he has spoken out on, which is union efforts, right? I mean, he got very much behind the auto from your neck of the woods, the auto workers.
He did.
In their strike. And you saw the Volkswagen plant this past week where the workers voted to unionize. So, I mean, I think some of that would be to say, look, I'm putting stuff into the ground. And you're going to see stuff in the next few years that's going to start being built. And we're going to build it with, you know, union labor. And we're going to be putting all kinds of pressure on corporations to deliver higher wages, even if it's not unionized. Right. And there's all kinds of levers you have if it's a federally funded project. So I think there are things you can do. But that then gets back to that question. Whatever you do, you've got to sell it. You've got to go back and forth. You've got to speak vigorously. And that does speak. It's an open question mark as to can he pull that off?
Yeah, yeah. Okay, Michael Powell of The Atlantic. What a wonderful conversation about inflation and politics and the economy. Thanks so much for joining us here on Created Equal.
Oh, I really enjoyed the conversation. Appreciate it.
So I think the summary here is that, you know, President Biden's got a pretty tough set of choices in front of him in terms of convincing middle class and working class people to vote for him in November. And there aren't a lot of great options.
Right. I imagine that maybe this is not how this works. I'm not a political strategist. But I imagine you could at least say these are investments in our long-term health, right? Like what he's doing now may have raised the price of food in your daily goods, which I understand you're hurting. Maybe there's a sympathy there. But these may be for longer-term gains. I don't know. That might be the pitch I would go for if I were president, not that you asked.
You know, and it's also about, you know, doing things now that will remind people of whose side, quote unquote, he's on.
That's true.
You know, this new effort to get rid of some of the student loan debt that people are carrying, that definitely falls into that category. You know, he's got to demonstrate that he's their ally and that he's doing these things for them, not doing things to them. That's it for Created Equal. You can listen to recent episodes at WDET.org and make sure to subscribe to our podcast where you can leave us a rating or a review. Created Equal is produced by Carrie Jr. II and David Lines. The audio editing is by Connor Anderson, and the music is by Sam Bobian. Created Equal is a production of WDET, a listener-supported service of Wayne State University.